Our second reading this morning comes once again from the Gospel according to Mark, this time chapter 9, verses 2 through 9. That's on page 919 in your pew Bibles. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain, apart, by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. And his clothes became dazzling white, such as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Then Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah." He did not know what to say, for they were terrified. Then a cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud there came a voice, "This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they saw no one with them anymore, but only Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, he ordered them to tell no one about what they had seen until after the Son of Man had risen from the dead. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
If you've been with us for the last few weeks, you'll notice we skipped ahead a few chapters from the very beginning of Mark to chapter 9 in the middle. Today is Transfiguration Sunday. It's the last Sunday before the season of Lent, and this is the Sunday in our year when we remember this particular part of Jesus' story. This is the original mountaintop moment. Jesus takes just three of his disciples up the high mountain, leaving the rest to deal with the crowd that was surely still following him everywhere. And when they arrive at the summit, something in the fabric of the universe changes. And Jesus' entire appearance, including his clothes, changes before their eyes. And suddenly Moses and Elijah are also on top of this mountain, and the three of them are discussing something. For the aspiring biblical scholar, this passage is an absolute treasure trove of thinly veiled references to other biblical passages. In six short verses, you can find at least a couple dozen references to parts of the Exodus narrative, the Old Testament prophets, other parts of the Gospels, and even a few of Paul's letters. Now, I promise not to go full Bible nerd on you this morning, but I do want to talk a little bit about a couple of those references because I think they're important to how we understand the story. The first has to do with the characters. The disciples and the early readers of Mark's gospel would have heard this story and immediately thought of two other biblical figures whose stories involved mountains, clouds, shining faces, and the voice of God. The first is Moses. After the people of God left Egypt, Moses left Aaron behind and took Joshua up the mountain, into the cloud that was the presence of God among them, who had led them into freedom, and Moses received the covenant there. When he came down the mountain, his face was shining, not just in a really excited to be here kind of way, but in a slightly unnatural way, because he had seen the glory of God, and it stuck to him like glitter in a kindergarten classroom. To the ancients, glory was a substance, not unlike glitter, that would rub off on you as you got close. Moses, when he went up and down the mountain, eventually had to begin wearing a veil over his face because the people couldn't handle it. They were afraid. The second person that they immediately would have thought of was Elijah, who, after being sent into the desert, fleeing for his life, spoke with God. Elijah encountered God on another mountain, and listened to the roar of waves and wind and fire before he heard God's still, small voice. So it's not a coincidence, then, that Moses and Elijah are the ones to meet Jesus on that mountain. But it is curious that Jesus' face is shining, and not seemingly from having encountered God the way that Moses did. Rather, Jesus radiates the glory of God in this moment from within. The second thing that I want to point out has to do with words. God quite literally quotes God's self while talking Peter down. Just a few weeks ago, we heard these same words when Jesus was baptized. He was coming up from the River Jordan, the heavens opened, the Spirit descended, and the voice of God came, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased." So, in this mix, we have three people who've been directly addressed by the voice of God in their lifetimes. And they're all standing on a mountaintop chatting. Chatting about what? We'll never know. But then Peter interrupts them. He assumes rightly that Jesus brought them along to this divine appointment for a reason. But like any tradesperson faced with an unspeakable mystery, Peter falls back on what he knows: physical labor. One of my colleagues joked this week that Peter, in this moment, began what would become a time-honored church tradition. Facing a terrifying existential threat, the glory of God, by proposing a building project. Peter might not have any idea what to do in the presence of the glory of God, but he does know how to build things. We can only assume that James and John were just standing there in shocked, reverent silence. But not Peter. Peter is already scanning the hillside for branches and brush with which to make shelters, not so much for anyone to rest in, but as a way to mark their presence. An altar of sorts, a way to mark this holy place in a way that makes sense to him. Even Peter wished to dwell in the presence of the Lord, even if just for a little while. But then God interrupts Peter and speaks those same words from Jesus' baptism to call him back to his center. But this time, God adds a command on the end. "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." Peter and James and John are not present in this moment as laborers. They're here as witnesses. Jesus brought them to the mountaintop to see and experience the glory of God and to tell about it later. I have a soft spot for Peter because he's the guy who says what everyone else is thinking. He's the one who is more willing to be wrong than to be quiet. He's always right there with Jesus, poking around in the middle of things and asking questions. And sometimes that gets him in trouble, and this is one of those times. But I think a lot of us have been in Peter's shoes at some point in our lives. Maybe not literally on a mountain with Jesus and a cloud, but when we're faced with an inexplicable mystery, an event that words can't do justice for, a moment when we realize that God really is with us, we try to speak. We try to explain. We refuse the stunned silence in favor of nervous, busy work. We try to do something. Anything to quantify or qualify or set boundaries or contain the mystery. For most of us, I think, it is much more difficult to sit still and bear witness to God in the world than it is to put up a couple of tents. We are so often the Marthas and the Peters who want to take care of Jesus rather than watching him at work. And that's not always a bad thing. Jesus was human, after all, and he needed to eat. But sometimes we need to be the Marys and the James and the Johns who sit and listen. By the time God is finished speaking to Peter, it's over. The moment has passed, and they can go back to following their very human friend, Jesus, around. Richard Rohr is a Roman Catholic priest who writes on the intersection between contemplation, the work of bearing witness, and action. In his book, Everything Belongs, he says it this way. When we see that the world is enchanted, we see the revelation of God in each individual as individual, then our job is not to be Mother Teresa. Our job is not to be Saint Francis. It's to do what is ours to do. That, by the way, was Francis's word as he lay dying. He said, "I have done what was mine to do. Now you must do what is yours to do." We must find out what part of the mystery is ours to reflect. Our first job is to see correctly who we are and then act on it. That will probably take more courage than to be Mother Teresa. To be really faithful to that truth is utterly difficult and takes immense courage and humility. The most courageous thing we will ever do is bear humbly the mystery of our own reality. So, friends, what part of this mystery, that Christ has died, Christ is risen, and Christ will come again, what is ours to bear? In light of this, what is yours to do? After Jesus and his disciples start down the mountain, he tells them they must not tell anyone about that day until after his resurrection, which is a little bit longer for them than the 7 weeks we have to wait until Easter. So why show them something so mind-blowing and then ask for secrecy? I think Jesus knows that this day, this moment, will only make sense in light of the resurrection. Only in hindsight will God's words and Jesus' glory and the presence of those ancient greats come together in a coherent story. It'll take a while to connect those dots. Honestly, it's the resurrection that makes sense of just about everything Jesus says and does. Perhaps that's why Jesus chose disciples who were not religious scholars. They were fishermen and tax collectors and shopkeepers. They didn't know what they were getting themselves into, but they asked their questions without too many presuppositions or well-thought-out arguments, and they followed, and they trusted, and eventually they knew the mystery of God taking on flesh and dwelling among us. It's Jesus' humanity that gives us the courage to live our very human lives in all of their complexities and stuff. But it's Jesus' divinity that gives us the courage to trust that because God loved the whole cosmos, everything that was and is to come. God loved all of that enough to send the Son into the world. And because of that, God's love is absolutely big enough to envelop us with all that we are and all that we have and all that we carry. Because we are united with Christ, we too hear those same words spoken to Jesus at his baptism. This is my beloved child, with whom I am well pleased. Thanks be to God. Amen.